This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 84.
So look down deep, and when you look at AI, it's not AI that's going to take your job. It's going to be somebody using AI who's going to take your job. And the reality is AI itself will automate tasks that will change jobs and that will transform careers. This is not jobs. These are tasks that are being automated, things that are mundane. And what we're finding is just the opposite. People who use these tools, who actually use these tools to transform their work, say, I am finding joy in my job now. All the tedious, mundane things that weighed me down, those are all gone, and I can now focus on the things that I love about my job.
Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Hey everyone, this is a very special episode in partnership with the Institute for Corporate Productivity, also known as I4CP, where I had the opportunity to attend their annual Next Practices Now conference in Scottsdale, Arizona. If you are not familiar with I4CP, they are the leading research firm that discovers and advances next practices in human capital. Supported by a powerful community of human capital practitioners, they provide HR research and insights that help organizations better anticipate, adapt, and act in a constantly changing business environment. And their annual Next Practices Now conference is an amazing, amazing event. Over 3 days, 500 HR leaders came to Scottsdale, Arizona, where they were treated to over 25 different presentations and keynotes by thought leaders and world-class HR practitioners. I was fortunate enough to be able to sit down and interview 7 of those amazing speakers and bring their insights directly to you. As you can imagine, generative AI was a hot topic. And we went deep on that on several different angles, including why HR needs to lead on AI, its role in learning development, and the watchouts for creepy analytics and AI, and much, much more. So who are those amazing speakers you're going to hear today? Prasad Sethi, Charlene Lee, Diane Gerson, Elliot Macy, Monica Poole Knox, Sal Folletta, and Kevin Oakes. First up is Prasad Sethi. Prasad's a lecturer at Stanford Graduate School of Business and former VP of People Ops and Workspace at Google. Prasad's presentation was titled Tech It Up a Notch, Gen AI for HR Leaders. And not only was this an insightful presentation on AI, but Prasad kicked off his presentation by sharing a song he created for HR leaders using the Gen AI tool Sunu. Without further ado, here is HR's Crushing It and Prasad Sethi.
They're the ones who keep the team together, making sure we're always on the right track, finding talent in every kind of weather. They got the skills they never lack. Ooh, yeah. HR superstars, they're crushing it, making sure everything's legit, finding the best, they're never gonna quit. HR superstars, they're the real deal. They got the power to make us all feel that we're in good hands. They're the HR seal.
Prasad, thank you for spending some time with us. You had a terrific presentation today called Tech It Up a Notch, Gen AI for HR Leaders. And I have to commend you because you started that presentation by using AI to create a great song called HR's Crushing It. I would love to get that song and put that on here for everybody. It was tremendous.
Thank you, JP, for having me. It was so much fun creating that song, right? And there's a platform called Suno.ai. Anyone can play around with it. And I thought, hey, whenever you come to conferences, you got to know your audience. And I knew what audience I was speaking to, and I just wanted to give them a little boost.
Well, it was a crowd pleaser, maybe be a top 10 hit in the HR world. Let's talk about what are HR leaders getting right and getting wrong about Gen AI and their capabilities?
I would say in my talk, I focused on a few different things. One is that the capabilities of this technology are growing at such a mind-boggling pace. processing power for AI over the last 10 years has grown a millionfold. And over the next 10 years, it's projected to grow another million. So we don't know what kinds of capabilities will come in. But we are already seeing enough signs that AI is going to infuse all work. And so my view is that who better than HR leaders, people leaders, to absorb it for themselves, become power users, showcase through the HR function how they can deliver new capabilities using this technology, and most important of all, be a beacon for their entire organization, because everyone is going to be navigating this journey, perhaps with excitement, but also a lot of fear. And who better than HR leaders to guide people in that journey?
That's such a great message. We have to do this. I think it's really, this is ripe for HR to have a huge impact.
Yeah.
But you said people are a little bit afraid. It's like, how do you get started? Because technology can be intimidating. And when AI is everywhere and it's so hyped, what are those first steps you recommend HR leaders do to start to get to know it and understand it so they can help transform the organization?
I think one part is certainly some demystification and education for themselves about what this technology is, how it is different from perhaps other technologies that have come before. Part of what I think about when I think about sense making of LLMs, large language models, which is how we typically have interacted with Gen AI, is that there are a few things that are very different about this technology. There's no instruction manual. There is no one single outcome that these are built for. And they don't give you reliable output, right? They don't give you the same, if you have the same prompt or same input into this today versus tomorrow, it might give you something slightly different because these are probabilistic models. And that is so different from how we have thought about technology in the past when we've used it for automation. We basically said, we wanted to do one thing. We want you to give us an instruction manual so that we can train everyone on it. And we certainly want consistency when we do the same thing over and over. And so this is a very different type of technology than we've been used to. And so for HR leaders to get a sense of, okay, if that is what characterizes this technology, and then because of those shortcomings, it actually has some advantages, though. It doesn't have an instruction manual, but that means that anyone in my organization could suddenly become a power user and they can be the best in the world at a certain task, because they've figured it out that no one else has. Even though it's not used for any one purpose, you can use it for everything around you. And that is what we do typically in knowledge work, right? Like, we are doing a little bit of a lot of things. And so maybe it can be a tool that's helpful to us in our daily lives. And even though it doesn't have reliability, it compensates for it with the surprise element. And it might actually give you a spark and influence your own creativity. And so I think just getting that kind of view around it, and then there's no substitute, of course, for getting your own hands dirty, or we are wise. I don't know how to say, like, wise dirty. That seems like bad. But a lot of these technologies, you can interact with them with spoken language or written language. And that, to me, is a great equalizer. And other types of technology took perhaps a lot of effort before you could actually engage with them. But this is so easily accessible to everyone. You just need a phone or an internet connection, and you need comfort with communicating via any language. It doesn't need to be English, via text or speech, and suddenly you're off, right? And in that sense, I think the more that they get exposure to this technology, the better they will be equipped to help others through this journey.
That's a really interesting point you're making, because it's not as reliable as tech in the past, right? We expect something to have one input and give it the same output every time, which you can get to that maybe with Gen AI, but it's more challenging. The question for me is thinking about a lot of the reports I'm seeing about, hey, this is going to take away the manual work, the repetitive work. How do you see a Gen AI kind of having that impact, even though it's really more for knowledge work in a lot of ways?
There is a lot of work that we all do. We call it knowledge work, but it's filled with drudgery, right? In our Stanford class, we encourage students to come up with startup ideas around the world of work, and we ask them to focus on disgusters. What is it that disgusts you at work? Because disgust is a very powerful motivational force, right? And we think of broadly two classes of things that disgust us and causes time poverty and thought poverty. Time poverty, because we all have too many things to do and not enough time to do it. Thought poverty, because in the attempt of doing all these things, we are constantly context switching and losing flow. We are going from an email to a meeting to a text, and we are very busy. We have a lot of activity going on, but it's not deep work. It's a whole bunch of shallow work. And so we have thought poverty as well. And I think Gen AI can really help us address both of those and help with that kind of automation, whether it's about introducing us to new knowledge, whether it's about summarizing it, whether it's helping us with our own critical thinking. We can use Gen AI to automate a whole bunch of drudgery and help us be in a flow state.
I love that. Time poverty and thought poverty. That really resonates for me. Another question for you, Prasad, is how do you think about people analytics leaders in the age of Gen AI? What's the role they can play for the HR team and the organization?
I think it's such a ripe opportunity for people analytics leaders to step up. One is in the context of their own work. Now you have a lot of Gen AI-based analytics tools. Your listeners should check out Julius.ai or Accio, for instance. With Julius.ai, you can import any spreadsheet in there, and you can have a conversation with Julius, just like you would do with ChatGPT about that spreadsheet. And it's actually writing the Python scripts. It's showing you what it's doing in Python, and it's having a conversation with you about it, right? Anyone can do it. You don't need to know Python because it's doing the Python for you. So I think it's going to change a whole bunch of analytical work, and hopefully it will make more HR people, because all you need now is the ability to understand statistics rather than being able to perform statistics, right? And so I think it will, in that sense, democratize access quite a bit. The role that people analytics leaders can play with their functions, I would call on two things. One is, I absolutely think that they can be incredibly useful for the organization if they have more context. And one of the things that I would always say that led to our success and my success at Google was right from day one, reporting to the head of HR, right? And making sure that we had context on what business problems we were solving, rather than starting from the data. A lot of companies say, I have an analytics team, what can they do that's new? That is very different from the approach I would take. I would say, what are the business problems you're trying to solve? And now how can analytics help you solve them better, faster, cheaper, right? And so that's the approach I would take on context. The second one is, I think a lot of people analytics folks should start thinking of themselves as product creators rather than analytics experts or helping with process efficiency or program design. I think the world of HR itself needs to become a lot more product focused, where you're designing certain things at scale for a lot of people to use, rather than thinking of ourselves as process designers, where there's a lot of people input that goes into making something well. And I think people analytics leaders can truly be at the center of that.
Next, Charlene Lee, best-selling author and founder and CEO, Quantum Networks Group, talk to us about embracing the AI revolution and transforming HR for the future of work. Charlene has been on the cutting edge of tech for 20 plus years, and this time is no different. She is working on a new book called Winning with Generative AI, a 90-day blueprint for success that will be a must-read for all HR leaders. Charlene, thanks for talking with us at the conference today. You've got a new book coming out called Winning with Generative AI, a 90-day blueprint for success. I couldn't be more excited to this book because we need this. So I'm excited to talk about the book with you, but tell us more about why you wrote the book and kind of what you hope people take away from it.
Well, when generative AI hit at the end of 22, I immediately started using it and realized this was going to change our lives forever. And I'd been in the business and technology space for 25 years, and I have never seen a technology like this. And it's not even a technology. It is a paradigm shifting transformational force. And I realized that we need to look at this from a very different perspective. And it was going to change the way we work, the way we live, the way we connect with each other. In fact, I think it's going to make us better humans. So HR needs to absolutely be involved, and people need to think about this in a very different way.
Yeah, I love that you say it's that transformational, because I don't think we really have figured it out yet. But it's so important that organizations get this right. And to your point, HR has got to lead the way. So tell us more about what you think HR leaders need to be doing to prepare their organizations for AI.
Well, first of all, this is going to be a people transformation. technologies are useless without people using them. And so the only way you're going to transform your organization and the way you work, the way you serve your customers, is for people use these technologies. And that requires leadership. And so my key recommendation to every organization is to train your top two levels of executives. And even as you're pulling together what I call the minimally viable team, the minimum number of people to put together your generative AI strategy, make sure that HR is at that table. Because if this is going to require the transformation of people, your top people person needs to be there at the very beginning.
And so getting the leadership team together, train them AI, what does that look like in real terms? Is it them getting into the tools, learning the history of it, understanding the use cases? Because I think there's a lot of consultants that are coming in with different solutions right now, and there are going to be some people need some guidance here, Charlene.
I think the number one thing to think about this is that you have to get your hands into it. And the biggest concern that everyone has is, can I do this safely? Can I be secure? How do I not jeopardize our company's reputation, our trust with our customers and with our employees? So staying safe and secure is absolutely essential. I like to say that if you want to go fast, you have to have great brakes. So you have to know that and have the confidence that you can stop, change course, know what's happening here so that you can enter into the space instead of with fear and uncertainty, with curiosity and confidence. So setting up an AI playground, teaching people how to be safe, even before you have generative AI guidelines, and most companies don't, and they are using AI, how do you use critical thinking? How do you train people on how to do things they already know how to do, but do it with AI better, faster, and more efficiently?
Yeah, that's a really, really great point, because it augments our work, but it requires us to change our behaviors. We all like to drive the same way to work every day. Taking a shorter route may be different because I don't like to go that way. I haven't done that for 20 years, even though that's faster. And so it's kind of the same thing with AI. Well, how do I build this into my workflow, right?
Yeah, I think of it as when we do the initial training, we train the leaders to do things that they already know how to do. And so it is, how do you write? How do you do analysis with data? How do you do research? If you're in a sales team and you can do research on your prospective customers in seconds instead of weeks, that is transformational. And how do you use it as a thought partner? You have an idea, you want to vet it. Who can you go and talk to? Now you can use AI to say, like, give me the pros and cons of this argument. Help me make it better.
I think that's really interesting. But Charlene, think about the culture piece, right? How do you see this changing cultures? You know, what advice do you have around that, on that 90-day blueprint?
Well, culture is made of beliefs and behaviors. And so if you want to change your culture, especially things like, can we move fast? Can we use these technologies? Can we actually change? Can we challenge this one phrase that I think is the thing that sinks many companies? Well, that's the way we do things around here. Whenever you hear that, you want to ask yourself, hopefully it triggers, well, why do we do things like that around here? Is there a better way? We may try a better way and we may go back, but we should at least try. Take a look at this. So that's the culture change that has to happen. And what I've seen is that companies who are comfortable disrupting themselves, being agile, questioning, people who have that culture built into the way they work are much more adaptive and able to look at generative AI. I know very large organizations that would, on paper, would be highly threatened because of the work that they do, call centers, for example, business process outsourcing. And they are at the very forefront of this, finding productivity gains and using those gains not to fire people, but to elevate them, to find new cycles, to develop new products for their companies, and developing significant competitive advantage.
That's a great point. And you being in the tech space for 25 years, what is your take on people saying, well, AI is going to take our jobs? Is that really true when you look at the history of tech?
No, if you look at ATMs, right, we thought that decimated the bank tellers. Actually, it stayed the same. And so banks use the productivity and the lower cost of opening up new branches to, again, provide better services for people, but they need people in those branches. So they didn't have as many tellers at the same bank, but they opened many, many other banks. So the number of people working in bank branches has actually stayed the same since the advent of ATMs.
So look down deep. And when you look at AI, it's not AI that's going to take your job. It's going to be somebody using AI who's going to take your job. And the reality is AI itself will automate tasks that will change jobs and that will transform careers. This is not jobs. These are tasks that are being automated, things that are mundane. And what we're finding is just the opposite. People who use these tools, who actually use these tools to transform the work, say, I am finding joy in my job now. All the tedious, mundane things that weighed me down, those are all gone, and I can now focus on the things that I love about my job. So we're seeing this huge transformation, and the numbers are 4 out of 5 employees want training on AI. They believe it's going to transform their careers. 53% of employees believe that their jobs are going to change in the next year because of AI. And what are we as leaders doing? We're saying nothing. We're not giving them the training that they want. And so I believe it's incumbent on us as leaders, and especially in the HR space, to take a leadership role, to say we owe it to our people, to train them, to make them as employable as possible, to prepare them for this future. And while they're employed with us, they're going to add so much value to us. So let's move forward instead of just staying static.
So well said, and I cannot wait to see Winning with Generative AI, 90-Day Blueprint for Success. And I think the main message we need to take away is leaders need to lead, and that top team needs to get moving and get trained on AI as soon as possible.
Right. There's a knowing, doing, leading gap. We know it's important. We're maybe doing it a little bit, and we definitely need to step up and lead.
Hey, everyone. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. The Institute for the Future recently came out with a report that said 85% of jobs that will exist in 2030 haven't been invented yet. While I can't predict the future, I am certain that the only way to future-proof your career is by learning to learn. This applies to our organizations as well, and as HR leaders, our job is to ensure our team members have the skills and capabilities needed now and in the future. This is why I'm excited to announce the Future of HR podcast is now sponsored by Biz Library. Biz Library is the place where learning happens. They're your one-stop shop for all of your compliance, upskilling needs, and leadership development challenges. Biz Library is an industry leader for high-quality, off-the-shelf content that will solve your compliance needs, support the upskilling of teams, and will help your leaders to lead. If you're looking to elevate learning in your organization, give Biz Library a call as they can support you with their innovative L&D platforms, best-in-class content, and unrivaled strategic support. And if you mention that JP at the Future of HR podcast sent you, you'll receive a 10% discount on year one of your Biz Library contract. So head on over to bizlibrary.com and see how they can help you to elevate learning in your organization today. Next up is Diane Gerson. Diane is a former IBM CHRO and serves on several boards, including Kraft Heinz, Centavo, and TechWolf. Diane spoke on culture and human capital risk, the view from the board, and this was an insightful conversation for CHROs and anyone who aspires to the C-suite. Diane, thank you for spending a little time with us today. You had a great presentation talking about culture and human capital risk, the view from the board. I was fascinated. I thought it was very insightful. And you had one quote that I want you to explain a little bit more. You said one of the board members you work with that said that if you don't tend to a campfire, you end up dealing with a forest fire. Tell us more about what that means from a board perspective.
Yeah, so that actually came out of, if you can imagine, the Journal for Corporate Accounting. They did a study of culture, which is in itself pretty amazing, right? But they are focused on it because they realize that the value on the balance sheets of their companies is mostly intangibles. And the intangibles have to do with human capital, not financial capital or physical capital. And they're starting to really focus on it. So yeah, I thought that was a really interesting quote. If you don't tend to the embers of the campfire, the board of directors ends up battling a forest fire. And we've seen that over and over again, Boeing, of course, being the most recent example.
As an HR leader, if we miss some of these unethical or
poor choices that leadership are making that can impact culture and then have reputational risk.
Right.
It's a big deal. And so I guess that's what that board member meant is, well, how do we start to understand what's going on sooner and have early detection systems so that we can prevent that forest fire?
That's it, right? They don't want to be hearing about it in the news. They want to have their arms around the early warning signals and understand what's being done about them. When you think about it, boards were set up when physical capital and financial capital were what mattered. That's what drove value. And so they had, what do they have? Income statements, balance sheets. They don't get that kind of thing from HR when it comes to that intangible of human capital. And they need it. They don't want to be caught flat-footed anymore.
This is a really important topic. We could have a whole podcast on this one because I think we're still measuring human capital and people wrong on balance sheets in terms of like how we think about making investments or right. not. You know, we don't depreciate training for leaders over totally. 10 years, but yet, or not depreciate a truck I bought. So I think debates we can do there. But let's talk more about how HR leaders can be more proactive in making sure there aren't forest fires happening in their organizations.
Yeah, well, look, HR is sitting on a ton of data that maybe needs to be mined, right? And we now have that capability with AI and Gen AI. So let's just talk about exit interviews. They happen all over your company. They could be done better, but there's a lot of data in exit interviews. Investigations. The people who do investigations tend to be focused on, is this claim substantiated or not? And then they close the book after that. It was substantiated or no, it was not substantiated. But a ton of information was gathered in interviews. What happened to that information? Could that be mined? Then, of course, we've got certain patterns of people leaving in certain areas, certain valued skills or just leaving the company. People are posting for jobs in other areas. They seem to be leaving an area for some reason. We've got our engagement surveys. We've got our pulse surveys. We've got a lot of data. The question is, are we able to pull it together on some multi-source analytics platform and actually make sense of it and see the patterns and see the themes? Because that's what AI can do for us. And I think that is that's the power of HR now, is that we can really support the board in looking at the early warning signals and do something about it ahead of time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. To have the capability we have now with AI or technology, it's still probably a little bit more difficult than we'd love it to be. But
yes.
I think your point on investigation is spot on. That's such a missed opportunity. And then I think for CHROs to think about, how do you put this together in a way that's telling that story? And you talked a lot about culture health and how you measure culture health. Talk right. a little bit more about that.
Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, having an investigations channel isn't the be all and end all. Although in the Boeing case, they discovered no one quite knew where it was and it wasn't clear. But even if you have a clear one, if you don't have the psychological safety for people to speak up, then that's not going to work either. So part of culture health is ensuring you have that psychological safety, and you can measure that. You can ask people, do you feel comfortable that you can raise issues with your management or with the channels that are available to you? Do you feel like you know what they are? And there are questions that we can be asking and should be asking to make sure that we've got that. Of course, that's the foundation for people thriving in the workplace anyway. And toxic workplaces, while they've always existed, current generations have such a low tolerance for them. And so we really do need to focus on creating that thriving workplace.
I should probably thank our new generations for not tolerating
yes.
toxic workplaces, which is tremendous. But it's a spotlight or putting a spotlight on these behaviors and making sure that we are monitoring and taking care of them, proactively solving them, right? And getting the right,
right
culture.
And I would say not just solving them like, here's a bully, let's give them a warning. But more systemically, right? How are managers actually rewarded? When we think about promoting someone, are we looking at their inclusion and survey? Are we looking at their engagement survey? These are all things we should, and many companies are doing. Certainly we did it at IBM, and it made a huge difference. When we had it, we had managers who were kind of in the lower quartile when we looked at things like top performers leaving or not much career movement or not much skills improvement or low engagement scores and low inclusion scores. And we looked at it all together, bundled it together and said, that's the bottom quartile. Let's go back to those people and say, we need to do some training. And if they come and do the training and they improve, great. If they don't come to the training or they come but they don't improve, then they shouldn't be managers. Mm. And that's the kind of action that we as an HR team can do.
Absolutely. For CHROs who are listening, who are going to be talking to their board, you had three great questions that I think we had to make sure we shared them, because if we don't, I'd be remiss. I thought they were excellent questions. So Dan, what questions should CHROs be prepared to discuss with their board?
Sure. There are three. One is, how is our culture actually being experienced? So what are the rankings that we have against our competitors in the earned media? You know, not the ones we paid for, but in social media. And of course, there are, you know, many of those out there. And then secondly, what insights are we getting, right? From surveys, investigations, sentiment analysis that we can all do now. And what actions are we taking? So that's, what's the culture? The second one is, what's the caliber of our workforce relative to what it needs to be? So we may have a strategy that's to transform or move into new areas. Do we have the skills to meet those needs? Do we have the managerial capability for a healthy workplace? Are we retaining our most valued players? Are high performers leaving at a lower rate than lower performers? These are all things that talk to the caliber of the workforce and the leaders. And then finally, and I think most importantly, is there any leadership behavior that's putting us at risk? And there, they're really talking about senior leadership, because those are the people that they interact with all the time, that they don't know the full story and they know it. Tell us what we need to know and be independent. That is really what they're looking for. They want to trust HR to help them guard against some of these incredible scandals that we see going on year after year. They don't want to be on that board. They want to be on a board that can guard against those scandals. So those are the three things that I think we need to be prepared to discuss with our board.
Really thoughtful, especially around that leader behavior risk. Is there a leader that is going to put us at risk because we don't know about it? And I think a lot of organizations, we have to decide, how much goodwill does someone get for great performance and how much will we put up with, right? Oh, hey, they're a superstar. They bring in a lot of sales.
Right.
But they have bad behavior. Right. We have to decide, are we going to put up with that or not as a culture? And it sounds like boards are increasingly not putting up with that bad behavior, which is terrific. You made one final point that I think was terrific as well. And I guess it came from a CFO that might have been talking about this. HR needs to take an oath of independence.
Right.
With the board or their CEO.
Right.
Tell us more about what that means, this oath of independence.
Yeah. So this came up, actually. I was a faculty member at the National Association of Corporate Directors and talking about human capital risk. And we were actually discussing the McDonald's case. One of the directors, these were all comp chairs, one of them said, I really want to trust my head of HR, but she's in the pocket of the CEO, and I'm not going to get a straight story from her. And one by one, everyone around the table agreed. I was blown away. I mean, this is the death knell for HR, right? Not to be trusted, particularly by the board. And I thought about it. And you know what? I was one of those CHROs too. I wasn't independent. I didn't feel comfortable speaking out and having a different opinion from my boss. And yet it is really important for them to feel like they can trust us. You need to have an independent discussion with the board, aside from when the CEO is not present, about matters that they want to hear about. But the thing that really hit me was when I spoke with one board director, she'd been a CFO, and she said, you know, Diane, I don't understand why this is so complicated. CFOs have to take an oath of independence with the board. Why don't CHROs do that? And I was like, I had no idea. That is such a good point. So that may be where we're headed. I really hope it is.
Next, I spoke to the always provocative and entertaining Elliot Macy. Elliot is a legend in the learning development space, and in our conversation on AI's role in L&D and the rise of the prompt engineer, he did not disappoint. Elliot, you are an expert in learning development. So my first question for you is, how will AI impact the learning development function over the next few years?
Everybody in every field has had a wake-up call. AI is here. And there are parts of AI that are amazing. There are parts of AI that are overly hyped. There are parts of AI that we haven't fully discovered yet. And I want to give it the time to evolve. And I think of AI as about a 7-year-old. hasn't even gone through its teens yet. And there are parts of AI that will only work if we have wonderful human intelligence, human design that goes with it. I think it's important for people in L&D to sit at the table, to sit at the table where AI strategy and functionality and impact will be discussed in their organization. And they need to have a little bit of fluency in that, but they don't need to be AI experts. You don't need to differentiate each LLM or understand what subroutines or dictionary training terms are there. What the L&D and the talent person needs to do is to say a very simple question. How might AI, as it matures, with great design, supercharge what we are doing in learning? How can it make it faster, better, more targeted, more personalized? And that's our amazing opportunity. And to do that, we're going to have to be experimenters, give ourselves the ability to fail, and prevent ourselves from becoming fanboys or fangirls about AI. Because if you become a fanboy or fangirl, you're going to be worshiping it rather than the much more important thing, which is experimenting with it. And there are going to be evolutions. I would predict in the next 12 to 14 months, what we now go to a search engine, whether it be Google or Bing, we're going to go to a hybrid of that. And in fact, you're already seeing both of those search engines are now embedding AI. And in fact, that's probably going to become the dominant output. Challenging for them from a revenue point of view because they get a lot of their money to have that sponsored element. And I also think what we will discover along the way is that AI will allow us to do something strategically in a way that is significantly more targeted. Just give you an example. Let's say we were thinking of assessing somebody's skill. Well, we can go out and we could build a test, you know, 20 items and the like. But what if we could build a test that was an assessment for one, based on your background, based on your job application, based on your LinkedIn profile? We start to give you questions or simulations or examples. And based on how each of your responses occur, it shapes what the next one. So we not only know what you know, but where do you stop knowing? Or what's your level of confidence with that? Now, our ability to do that, we can do it maybe one for many, but we don't have the manpower, the people power to do that one for one. Where AI will come up is the ability to use data and personalization to supercharge things that we do. And once again, it's going to require experimentation, failure. And I tell everyone we're at the early stages of the space race. You know, we ought to look at AI as an emerging thing. And once again, as I've said to you before, I think we're dealing in AI as being pretty young child right now, an exciting child, but they're not even in their teens. So we have to understand that we're dealing with a developmental piece and it's going to change and we're going to change and the media buzz of it is going to evolve along the way as well. Yeah. And I like to look at it from that point of view. So let's see, I'll give you five. I'll use my fingers to count here. Personalization is at the top. How do we end up going a bit farther than a assessment for one? But what about a curriculum for one? So for each learner in your organization, a curriculum evolves, not just by generating the content, because we may already have the content, but how do we choose it? How do we rank it? How do we deliver it? How do we put it together in a hybrid fashion? The second one is predictive data. How do we end up looking at data that will predict what somebody needs when they need it? Very often, I just was dealing with some folks from the United States Defense Department. And what they were saying is our biggest challenge is we deliver too much too soon before they need it. How do we shape that so that they're getting more of their learning at that moment of need, at that moment of curiosity? And once again, we have that ability in AI to do it. Another element of it will be how do we end up creating workflow support so that not just a learning moment, but a nudge moment, a coaching moment occurs in the process of work. And then finally, I think we need to deal with the globalization issue. In any of the fields in the United States or overseas, we're dealing with a significant population percentage where English is not their family language. And it may not be their number one learning language. How do we develop content, curriculum, learning approaches that can be globalized, not just through translation, but through cultural examples and by creating the context? I actually think the greatest moments of learning failure aren't bad instruction, but where the learner has the information and nowhere to put it because they don't have a context for it to fit in. Wow, that's something that AI can do, not generating the content, but massaging, selecting, formatting, and delivering it against personalization, against data, and against what the corporate learning culture is going to be.
Elliot, what should HR leaders be excited about when it comes to generative AI? And what should they be cautious about when it comes to generative AI?
Well, they should be excited about augmentation. I like to use that word augment, which is better than automate or replace. How do we augment something? I think they should be enormously excited about self-driving procedures. I was involved decades ago when an airline asked me to look at the very first time a kiosk went into an airport. And they were worried that passengers wouldn't go there, that their staff wouldn't go there, and the planes wouldn't take off on time. And now they're everywhere. There are going to be processes that are going to change radically with AI and design. What they need to be cautious about, and maybe the vendors that hear this won't be, is there's an enormous amount of AI washing that's going on. A good example of it is the other day, people send me things to look at that are emerging AI products, and somebody said, can we send you our new AI pillow? It's got amazing technology that's going to help you sleep better and live longer. I said to myself, what are they talking about? And then I contacted them and I said, well, what is an AI pillow? Well, it's the program that's underneath it. There wasn't a drop of AI, but they slapped that on there. You're going to see talent systems, learning systems, and you know other forms of internal databases come out. And I'm going to tell you, they're going to announce AI before its birth, certainly before it's a teenager. And once again, I want to nod my head and said, let me see it as it comes out. But ultimately, don't buy a product because it's AI. Buy a product because it's going to supercharge a process. It's going to augment your employees' performance, and it's going to give them a learning and HR and work experience that will keep them there because they're now getting the HR and the talent perspectives that they need. But I think the only other thing to worry about is you have to be at the main table. I worry. I've been in a number of very large organization meetings, and the HR director and the L&D director and the talent director weren't in the room. Bless their hearts, the IT people are important, but they're the plumbers. They're not the architects. And I believe we have to be the architects, not of the AI technology, but of the augmentation process that we want to happen in that process. Listen, you may use AI at some point if you have to do layoffs, but please, God, don't lay people off by AI. Meaning use it as something that might augment it even farther to say, now that you're leaving, let's give you a personalized package of support and the like. And I think we, as people in the people business, have to design the appropriate use. Finally, we have to keep our eyes open for the global companies that hear this. Every country is developing different standards, needs, and bans on elements of AI. Somebody sent me a dissertation proposal to review. I'm on a committee looking at that. And it was really good. And in the middle of it, there were 3.5 pages that I had written. But I talked to the person who wrote it. They had no idea. They had gone into a generative AI. It popped up. And I didn't complain. I said, buy me a dinner sometime. But we're still not at the transparency level around content and the rights level. And once again, globally, some of the laws, requirements, and compliance elements.
Yeah, I think you're right. We are certainly in the infancy of AI. But you also said something else that I have to ask you about, because you said HR really needs to have a space travel mindset when it comes to generative AI. Tell us more about that.
I had a wonderful opportunity a little while ago to be at a meeting with Jeff Bezos and the CEO of SpaceX, and they were talking about space travel. And it was really exciting. And bluntly, they're trying to go to the moon and then on to Mars. And we could have a whole other conversation about that. But what they asked us to do is not to say, we'll get to the moon because of AI. The way they're going to get to the moon is by looking at the elements that are changing. And once again, how do we optimize them? Now, if we're astronauts in that, you got to realize, go back to the early days of space days that you or your parents were alive to see. And suddenly it was exciting. There was a ship going around. I remember hearing beep, beep, beep from a Sputnik. And then there was a monkey or a dog. And then there were some astronauts without windows. And there were astronauts. And then they went to the moon. And each of those moments, they were explorers. They figured out stuff they didn't know. We could not get a moon ship back. And at NASA, they took all of the parts and they figured it out at that moment. That was the astronaut mentality. Let us be so excited about what these technologies and our innovation, and let's add robotics and facial recognition and quantum computing. I can go on and on for things we haven't even focused on, but be an astronaut. Be there and look at that. And when we asked Jeff Bezos, why does he want to go into space with his private space travel company? And he said, from space, we'll figure out how to do things better on Earth. We'll figure out how to more rapidly figure out a vaccine for a disease, or we'll look at the atmosphere and understand how to do things from a climate point of view. And that's what I think we need to do. Be explorers rather than customers, and give yourself permission to, as you said, play with it, break it, embrace it, question it, and then figure out how it fits in to, once again, supercharge what you're doing, augment what's happening in your organization, but don't brand it as an AI solution. Your employees don't want to hear that. They want to hear that they can get their learning, their benefits, their support, their requirements, their compensation, their promotion, better. Focus on that.
Next is Monica Poole Knox. Monica's a 2-time CHRO, HR tech advisor, board director, and she shares her thoughts on reimagining the role of the CHRO in the age of generative AI. While most of her career has been in tech, Monica has some insightful advice on how CHROs can lead and be out front when it comes to AI adoption. Monica, thanks for taking some time to sit with us and talk about your presentation yesterday around reimagining the CHRO role in the age of generative AI. This is definitely a hot topic, and you have some most of your career in tech, so I think you've got some good street cred to talk about Gen AI and how it's impacting us. So let's start there. How do you see the CHRO role shifting, transforming, changing in this age of AI?
Yeah, it's an interesting time that we're in right now. And as I talked about yesterday, there are so many challenges that are happening in our society. I talked about mental health, I think becoming a pandemic. That's an appropriate term. We talked about having two regional wars with employees, with family members impacted, mass shootings, all political divides and polarization. That's happening, quite frankly, globally. And the reality is that employees don't leave those challenges outside, you know, the proverbial door, if you will, of their companies. They bring their anxieties, they bring their issues to work because they're human. And so I think the role of the CHRO is probably more challenging now than it's ever been. But at the same time, it represents a massive opportunity for HR leaders. And look, there's definitely some shifting that's happening with, I think, a stat that I saw is more CEOs are leaving the post than ever before. And that's true of CHROs. And no judgment to that. People have to make the decisions that they feel are best for them, their families, and their careers. But for those who are really doubling down and see this opportunity as CHROs, I think it's very exciting for us, particularly now that we talked about this introducing of technology with all this these challenges that are outside our workplace door of Gen AI, this technology that we've all been talking about fairly regularly. And we're all trying to, figure out what that means. But I think the opportunity for the CHRO with this technology is one to step up and lead in a way that has huge business impact. And we've talked about this again over the years about the importance of delivering business impact from the HR seat. But I think this technology represents that now more than ever before. If you look at the technology, and again, we're still all learning what it's capable of doing, but it'll have the impact. It'll have impact across the entire business spectrum, but primarily in the space of jobs, skills, leadership, culture, certainly functionally within each of the functional areas of business, and certainly with business model or business strategy. But you can't get around the impact of Gen AI to the spaces that HR leaders work in. And when we're thinking about jobs and we're thinking about skills, we're thinking about org structures, that's the space where HR has expertise. And so I really believe that the HR leader can step up, pull a coalition together of the right people. Why? Because we have the skills of facilitation. We're very used and adept to identifying problems before they manifest, seeing around corners, working through difficult challenges. That's what we do every day. And then also understanding what the business drivers are, as well as the challenges. And so with that skill set that we have and the opportunity of impact of this technology, I think a CHRO is perfectly positioned to pull the right people together, likely the CIO, CTO, it could be the chief strategy officer, even the COO, whatever roles exist within your organization, as well as others, to start asking the right questions that will impact some of those areas that I talked about. I also think that the CHRO can also help with getting being a model, if you will, and looking at their own organization, looking at the HR operations through the lens of Gen AI impact, and remove some of the scariness and some of the fear that may exist across the organization with incorporating the technology. So I think it's an exciting time, and I'm a big believer in asking for forgiveness than permission. But quite frankly, with kind of the sentiment that you're hearing of anxiety, a little intrepidation of, oh, is this technology going to take our jobs? I actually think that HR leaders can provide some solutions and calm the nerves a little bit with kind of a practical approach to asking the right questions that for that organization will deliver the right solutions using the technology with significant business impact.
I think that's the right message and a great message for HR leaders to hear, that they can step up. They've got the skill set. They've got the capabilities. They can drive change, help the culture to shift, and think about what AI is going to mean for every aspect of the organization. So I'm 100% in line with you on that. And Monica, how do you think about implementing the first steps, you know, baby steps, with the idea that you walk before you run with generative AI? And getting started in this journey. Tell us a little more about how you think about that.
Yeah. And like, I've worked for smaller companies. I've advised smaller companies. I've worked for larger companies for a lot of my career. So the dynamics may differ depending on the size of the company. And also, is it a tech company, quite frankly, right? Because there's even some smaller tech companies that are kind of blazing the trail and are comfortable using newer technologies. But to get started, I think the majority of people, at least in my experience, even talking with some of the participants today, are certainly in the very nascent stages. They're definitely not advanced, and they're kind of taking baby steps. So what I say first is start where you are. You know, again, no judgment. This is not a race. You know, oh, you're behind. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's appropriate in some sense, but quite frankly, we're not in competition with each other. We should be supportive and trying to help each other figure this out. And those solutions are going to look different for every organization. So start where you are. The next thing I think it is that's important is to have clean data. And you really can't have a conversation about Gen AI without having a conversation about the quality of your data. And I say start within HR because it's, again, it's great to start experimenting in kind of a place that we know that we're comfortable with. And HR has a ton of data. We have so much data. Start there. But if the data isn't clean, and to be honest, look, the majority of the companies I've worked for, with the exception of a couple, struggle with having clean HR data. And so I think this is, again, based on my conversations with some of the attendees here, this is a very common problem. And so what I say is you can certainly spend some time going back to try to clean up data. It's a lot of time and energy. But what I would say is start focusing forward and think about what are the kind of changes you need to make in your processes to ensure that you have very high data accuracy going forward. Because if you don't put in good data to the models, you're not going to get good data out. So I would say start there. And the next thing is start to experiment. And there were some other speakers that talked about the importance of just trying things out. You don't have to have it all figured out. I say start with a hypothesis or maybe a problem you're trying to solve, a question you're trying to get answered, and just try. And also give folks within your organization the latitude to experiment as well. The other thing I would say is make sure you have the right partners. I talked earlier about the coalition. I think that's super important because anytime you're thinking about how you transform the business, that's a team sport. We shouldn't feel that we're carrying the burden of the whole company. If anything, we should think about how we can all, you know, not to say share the burden, because I don't want to make it seem this technology is a burden, but I do think people might feel that way because they're not comfortable with it yet. And I think the more we use it, the more comfortable we will get and the more people will willingly jump in and try things. You know, build your coalitions, learn from each other. And then that coalition is internal, but it's also external. Again, I firmly believe that we can learn from each other. And there's some folks here who are further along and are doing some very interesting things. And so what I would encourage folks to do is don't be shy about reaching out and spending some time to learn from peers. And then lastly, I do think it's super important to attend these types of events. Conferences. You can actually stay at home and put on your pajamas and enjoy a webinar and learn. You can also, there's a lot of things now published, do some reading and get yourself more educated. But again, I think the most important thing is give yourself the space to learn and fail and just give yourself grace to figure it out.
Thanks, Monica. That was a great message for HR on how they can lead generative AI for their organization and lots of practical tips. Thanks for being on the podcast. Next up is Sal Folletta. Sal is a professor of human resource leadership and organizational science at Drexel University. And he talked to us about creepy analytics and how we can avoid crossing the line and instead establish ethical HR analytics for smarter workplace decisions. This was a great conversation, and I appreciate how Sal is challenging us to think about ethics and what that means in the age of AI. Sal, you had a great presentation around creepy analytics and why it's more important than ever that we're thinking about ethics and HR and people analytics. Tell us a little bit more about what you talked about today.
When you consider all the transformational and technological advancements and trends and the future of work, the promise and potential of HR analytics has never been greater for the HR profession and organizations we serve. But over the last decade, there's been numerous books published and resources produced, conferences on the topic. Today, we have a robust global people analytics community. However, despite all of these amazing resources and the good intentions of the HR analytics community, I've witnessed this gradual erosion of workplace privacy and ethics alongside a datavication, if you will, or what I refer to as a quantified employee agenda that undermines the potential benefits that can be achieved. A lot of my friends and colleagues will say, hey, Sal, you know, big data doesn't mean big brother. But when you see all these workplace practices and technologies and stories that have made front page news, it gives you pause. To be fair, HR analytics means different things to different people. For some, it's simple HR metrics and reporting. For others, it's sophisticated predictive modeling and advanced research. So, you know, in my observation, there's been too much of a focus on what should be done rather than what should not be done. And there's a lot of hype and hoopla on the potential promise of analytics, but nobody's talking about the elephant in the room, that is the perils and paradoxes of HR analytics.
Yeah, Sal, that is so, so smart when you said we got to talk a lot about what we can do, not what we should not do with AI, people analytics, because we always want that new bright, shiny object, the new insight. And so we're always pushing that boundary of what can we do next? Yet we can cross a line because there's capability now that we're all in the same tech stack, whether you're in Microsoft Teams, there's a lot of data to exhaust. There's a lot of things that are being put out there that you could access if you want to.
Yeah.
You have the capability. The question, should you? So let's talk more about this because a lot of people, I think, need to describe or define what is meant by ethical versus unethical in your perspective in analytics.
Yeah. Ultimately, ethics is in the eye of the beholder, if you will. But in general, what might be ethical to one person may be questionable, right, to someone else. And so it depends on your own internal core values and your ethical codes and principles, really, at the end of the day. But if you think about what ethics is a branch of philosophy, right? It deals with moral principles and values. It comes up with questions like right and wrong, good, bad, involves our moral obligations and responsibilities, personally, professionally, et cetera. And as many people know, ethics is not the same thing as legal, right? Just because something is legal doesn't necessarily mean it's ethical, right? So when you look at HR analytics and all of the digital technologies such as AI and automation, ethics is usually an afterthought and will vary depending on the context and the stakeholders involved. So for example, a business leader at the C-suite, if you really think about it, their ethical imperative, they have a fiduciary responsibility to ensure shareholder value, to drive profitability and performance and productivity, right? That makes sense. And that's right. Fair. So that's their ethical imperative, right? Whereas an academic like me, for instance, and I have a practitioner background as well, but someone like me that has an HR background tends to look at it through the lens of moral philosophy and what we should do, whether we should adopt a particular tool or technology or practice in the first place. So from an executive's point of view, let's unpack that a little. If an executive may have already decided we're going to adopt this AI-powered tool or technology, or we're going to implement this particular people analytics practice. So the decision is already made. So ethics becomes kind of a moot point. And then from their perspective, it's all about mitigating the risk. But risk mitigation is different than ethics. I mean, it involves putting ethical guardrails around your practices and technologies that you adopt, but the decision was already made to do it in the first place, right? Ideally, what you want is where stakeholders, including the people analytics leader, head of HR, for example, and the C-suite and the IT leader are having an open and honest dialogue about the ethicality of procuring a particular AI-powered platform in the first place. But that rarely happens in practice. Usually it's an afterthought, and then it's all about mitigating the risk. Does that make sense?
It does. Makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, two things popped up as we were talking is that in HR and business, a lot of times we make decisions and there's intended and unintended consequences. And with AI, it's probably even more high risk now because we don't always know the unintended consequences where we might be able to figure that out in the past.
Yeah.
And so what I think I'm hearing, tell me if this is how you've been thinking about or talking with clients, is that each organization really needs to figure out what does ethical mean to them? Like, what are the lines they won't cross? How will they use this? What are they going to tell their employees? How transparent will they be? And what technology and tools will they be using for what processes? And being clear on that in the first place, which isn't really happening, to your point.
Yeah, there are some good companies, some particularly in the Fortune 100, that have robust people analytics capabilities and people analytics leaders that are well-intentioned. And they are beginning to have these discussions about ethics and privacy and the intended and unintended consequences, as you point out. And a lot of the leading companies now, you're starting to see companies formulating data governance and transparency policies, ethics charters, and they're doing this up front before they start formulating their people analytics agenda for a given year. And they're doing this up front in collaboration with senior stakeholders. But in my view, they don't go far enough. I think what we need to do, ideally, is to embed ethics in all of our people analytics capabilities and activities. And that means it's all about cultivating an ethical mindset or an ethical ecosystem across the entire HR analytics journey, right? So in my book, Creepy Analytics, I introduce a 7-step model. First step is to engage with stakeholders and determine their needs and requirements. But the key is to ensure you manage their ethical, the expectations in an ethical and responsible way, right? When you're dealing with stakeholders. Secondly, is when you define the HR research agenda, you want to make sure that your research questions and analytics questions are ethical and doable and realistic and legal. Then in terms of your data sources, a third step is you identify your data sources. But this is where you need to start asking critical questions like, to what extent can we hope to achieve strategic competitive advantage by adopting this particular AI-powered tool or this particular HR analytics practice? Ask yourself that question. If it's not a lot of strategic competitive advantage, you know, maybe you shouldn't do it if it's going to creep out your workforce, right? Your methods should be ethical as well. Usually when we gather data, we do it in an active way. That's a traditional approach where I give you a survey, for example, and you fill it out. So you are the participant, the employee is actively involved. Then there's passive data gathering, which involves covertly scraping and analyzing your digital exhaust of a candidate or an employee. Passive data gathering is a more of a novel approach. It's usually used for gathering novel data sources from like social media sites, blog posts, et cetera. And it's okay to use it. I would use it sparingly and only when you're unable to practically collect data in an active fashion. Right. But be transparent about it. That's the key. Being transparent, letting your employees know you're doing it. And then the other steps in the model in the book, you'll see it's about analyzing the data, of course, which is kind of self-explanatory. But you have to ethically interpret the data, be responsible in how you interpret the data, ethical insights, ethical analysis. Then when you get to the communicating the stories and the data and insights, you have a responsibility to tell a story. Storytelling is a very powerful approach to communicate analytical insights, but storytelling shouldn't be code for telling executives what they want to hear, right? That happens more often than we want to admit. Or an executive, a powerful executive will expect you to cherry pick the data and insights to, I don't know, support their preconceived agenda or some decision they already made. And that happens more than we want to admit as well. And so you'll see I have a 7-step model that outlines 7 ethical outcomes that organizations should implement to ensure they're doing people analytics ethically and responsibly.
Yeah, it's so important to be thoughtful and ethical when we talk about this analytics, especially in the day and age that we're at and we're connected to a phone or our PC and working all the time. One last question for you, though, is, Sal, when you think about for your advice for HR leaders, mm-hmm. how do they ensure they're avoiding unethical AI or creepy analytics? What's the path besides reading your book? What are 1, 2, 3 things that they should be thinking about to make sure they're staying above board?
Yeah, you want to develop, as I mentioned, an ethical ecosystem, right? You want to ensure that your practices, the entire journey embeds ethics in it. That's critically important, I think, first and foremost. You also want to make sure you use a collaborative approach when you are thinking about adopting AI-powered technologies. Now, AI is going to revolutionize people analytics. It already has. There are all kinds of SaaS-based platforms out there to analyze and measure and nudge and coach and provide feedback, et cetera, you know, of the workforce. And I think that's an amazing thing. It's giving us capabilities we never had before. However, we need to use a collaborative approach when procuring these technologies. What typically happens is someone outside of HR, maybe the IT officer, is making these procurement decisions without getting any input from anybody in HR. We need to be mindful of how we position people analytics. I believe it should report directly to the chief HR officer and squarely reside in HR. Not everybody believes that. Some have called for it to sit outside of HR and like a business intelligence function.
Tell us more about why you believe that. I'm interested.
Well, it's probably my own bias, my own lens. I was a former chief HR officer and a former head of HR research and analytics in a Fortune 100. And because of that, my extensive HR background, that's my bias. But I also recognize People analytics today is a team sport. We got business intelligence professionals, data scientists, behavioral economists, mathematicians, statisticians. All these players have entered the fray, which on one hand is amazing. It's great. But on the other hand, I'm not convinced or too sure that all of these disciplines, all these professionals in these disciplines receive the same level of training as a social, behavioral, or organizational scientist, or someone with a significant HR background that tends to subscribe to a set of humanistic values, right? I'm not saying that that makes all data scientists and business intelligence professionals unethical. No, not necessarily. They probably have a code of ethics, professional code of ethics, but I don't think they receive the same level of training as those of us in HR or those of us perhaps in organizational psychology, for instance.
I think also just to your last point on that, if the people analytics leader does report to the CHRO, it sends a message.
Yeah.
If you're burying your people analytics person down into the HRIS team or in your HR or ops team, what message are you sending there as well and asking for certain reports? I mean, dashboards isn't people analytics. So I think, you know, that's a great, great point.
Yeah. You know, absolutely. And then one last thing I'll add is that the role of people analytics, if you think about it, it's a catalyst for being more evidence-based in terms of decision-making, right? But our role doesn't stop with just generating the analytical insights and giving the data to executives, and they run off in a room, they scurry off, and then they formulate the strategy in a clandestine way. The role of the people analytics leader, they have a role in shaping the strategy and in assisting executives and the chief HR officer in what specific programs, practices, and technologies they adopt. So evidence-based, it doesn't mean just evidence-based on the front end with the people analytics capabilities. It also means, are you adopting evidence-based or science-based programs, practices, and solutions too on the back end? What happens is we spend all this money, millions of dollars, developing this incredibly precise system called people analytics, all these amazing capabilities to pinpoint critical business problems or employee engagement issues or the drivers that matter most to employees, only then to prescribe a solution that's non-evidence-based. That's crazy when you think about it, but it happens more often than we want to admit.
Last but not least, I sat down with Kevin Oakes, the CEO of I4CP, and asked him to share his reflections and the key themes that dominated the conference. Kevin, I've really enjoyed being here at I4CP's Next Practices Now conference. It has been a great event. And as you've been talking to members throughout the week, I wonder, what have you learned? What are some of the big takeaways from the conference been for you?
Yeah, there's been some distinct themes, I think, that we've seen in some of the presentations and then certainly in the private conversations. And no surprise, Gen AI has been one of those themes. A lot of organizations are still in inning number one of a 9-inning game here and trying to figure out how they're going to leverage Gen AI, first for just efficiency, but more and more they're beginning to think about effectiveness and how they can really harness the power of AI in what they're doing from an HR perspective. The applications are kind of all over the map right now. And what I really want to do as a research organization is try to winnow those down so people can really see what are some of the common applications. We know that talent acquisition and learning and development have probably used AI more than any other HR function up until this point in time, but there's some really, really interesting things happening in some of the other functions as well. And then, JP, I'd say the other area almost opposite that is diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's been some really good conversations around that. It's no surprise that DEI has been under tremendous backlash over the last year, year and a half. And the job of a chief diversity officer or any DEI executive has gotten incredibly harder amongst that backlash. And so a lot of organizations are worried about being sued if they have exec comp tied to DEI goals or really are talking about DEI in their 10Ks or annual reports. And so unfortunately, a lot of companies are sort of quietly, not talking about it, right? They're taking it out of their reports and they're downplaying a bit to what their goals are inside the organization. It's a marked contrast from where we were just less than 4 years ago in the wake of George Floyd's murder. And I think for DEI professionals, they're just wrestling with the current environment, but still trying to accomplish what they set out to accomplish.
Yeah, and it's so important that we have the conversation we're having this week around DEI and for the community to come together and really continue to move forward in what is a challenging environment.
Yep, for sure.
How many years have you had the conference now?
The conference predates me, actually. So if you recall, our organization is over 40 years old. We used to be called the Human Resource Institute, and we were founded by Rensis Likert, the creator of the Likert scale, and George Ordiorn, who was a Peter Drucker protege and really was the champion of management by objective. So they founded us a long, long time ago, and it was 17 years ago that we relaunched it as the Institute for Corporate Productivity. We had had this conference before we relaunched as I4CP, and we were typically doing it in Florida, in St. Pete, where my co-founder, Jay Jamrog, lives. But about 12 to 14 years ago, we moved the conference to Scottsdale. So it's just an annual highlight for us as an organization. And being a remote-first organization, it's really the only opportunity our employees get to have to see each other in person. So it's got that added benefit as well.
You can really tell that people really enjoy the conference, and there's a community feel to I4CP that I think is just unbelievable. It was truly a first-class event, so I was grateful I could be here and experience it.
Oh, I'm just so glad you could witness it, JP. It really is a fun time. And because we don't have vendors here and we don't have consultants at the conference, it becomes a really safe haven for great conversations and idea sharing between participants. And I hear that all the time from the participants. It's very cathartic for them to come to this conference and talk to some of their peers. I bumped into a woman yesterday who is from a 50-person company, and she spends her entire travel budget on this conference because she said it's the number one educational tool that she has at her disposal. So it's fun to hear stories like that for sure.
That's a great testimonial, Kevin. Thanks again for putting on an amazing conference with amazing speakers and just a great community of HR practitioners coming together.
Thanks, JP. I'm so glad you were able to be here.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe, share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us grow the podcast and helps with our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Ian Ziskin, who has 30 plus years of experience as a business leader, board advisor, coach, consultant, CHRO, entrepreneur, teacher, and author. He has received the Fellow of the National Academy for Human Resources, which is the highest honor in our field, a two-time CHRO, and written or co-edited 4 books that focus on how to improve organizations and how to elevate our field. Ian is a world-class HR leader. And in our conversation, we'll discuss the role of the CHRO and what great looks like, the emerging HR executive and what really matters, and how and where HR should invest in themselves. This was a great conversation and one you won't want to miss. Thanks again for listening to Future of HR and being part of our community.